Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt and taxes and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, with a love of fantasy books and funk, and a hatred of running more than 3 miles, Dave Denniston.
My name is Dave Denniston, your host, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. One of my obsessions has been helping physicians grow their practice. I've been hunting down various guests and resources to empower physicians to grow their practice to help them overcome burnout and debt. As a matter of fact, our next two guests are a couple of PhDs. And they are actually the first couple that I have the pleasure of interviewing together. The male half of this power couple, he's a veteran psychologist. He's a longtime CEO of a multi-million dollar consulting firm, which has serviced several Fortune 500 clients in the food industry. So he's had work, he's had theories, he's had research that have been published in major periodicals. The better half, and of course I mean the female half of this power couple, she's helped scores of people make a difference in other people's lives while making a living doing it. She's the president of the International Coach Certification Alliance, as well as an author, hypnotist, therapist, and a business coach. And actually she was telling me beforehand that she's interviewed thousands and thousands of physicians, so I'm really looking forward to hearing from both of them. I can't wait to hear about their journey. Please help me welcome Dr. Glenn Livingston and Dr. Sharon Livingston. Welcome, Glenn and Sharon.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Dave.
It's wonderful to be here.
Well, so glad to have you guys here. I think we can always learn from other people and their wisdom and their journey. Now, I did a little bit of reading. I've done a little bit of research, and I know this has been quite a ride for you guys so far. There's been a lot of transitions that you've gone through. But first, take us back a little bit. Take us back to the past in terms of this moment of more about you. And how did the two of you meet? How did you get together?
Would you like to tell that story, sweetheart?
Sure. Glenn and I were in a training program together, in a psychological training program together, and I fell in love with him at first sight, and I held my breath for 5 years until he married me.
5 years, wow. So the two of you, was this undergrad or grad education?
It was postgraduate program. It was, in analytical psychology, and it was a fabulous program, and Glenn was brilliant and gorgeous, and I was hooked.
Well, I'm sure Glenn, she probably looked pretty good herself, right?
She sure did. She sure did, yeah. We were friends for that 5 years first, and we helped each other with each other's relationships, and then we were single at the same time, and that was the story.
I can imagine that working. So tell us about the postgraduate stuff. And did you always, both of you, want to be PhDs? Tell us about that journey a little bit.
I was brought up in a family of psychologists and psychotherapists and social workers and counselors. I think there are, there are at least 20 mental health professionals in my family. And at least six of them are Dr. Livingston. So if we all go out to dinner together and the waiter says Dr. Livingston, I presume they all turn around. It's pretty funny. Although you don't want to come to my family reunion. It's not fun to watch a bunch of psychologists fighting about things. And so, yeah, I wanted to be a psychologist from the time I was 5 years old. My dad had been on the radio in the Vietnam era. And I asked my mom what my dad was doing on the radio, and she said, well, your dad makes people happy when they're sad. And I went into show and tell that week, and I said, I want to make people happy when they're sad, just like my dad on the radio. And so from the time I was five, I wanted to be a psychologist. That's all I wanted to do.
Interesting. Sharon, what about you?
Well, I realized when I was quite young that I came from a crazy family. And so when I was 13, I decided I wanted to be a psychiatrist. And I started, reading about stuff. And by the time I got into college, I realized that being a psychiatrist meant that you had to cut up a cadaver first. And that was not my thing to do. And so I majored in psychology and I've been interested in psychology basically since I was a young teenager.
Interesting. So both of you, you're molded on that from a young age. And of course, in this show, we focus on finances. And it's always just really interesting to me to see what's shaped, what's molded perceptions around money. So if you don't mind, each of you, what's been some of your biggest influences when you think about money?
Sure, I wanted to go first with that.
So I was brought up in a very humble family, and you know, we had to work really hard to make very little. And I always had a lot of ambition. Two of my brothers, by the way, are physicians, and they were extremely successful. And it was amazing to me. They were much older, and it was amazing to me that they broke out of that mold that my parents were in, which was almost subsistence, and succeeded. And I had a mother who told me that I could do anything I wanted to do. And so I pictured an abundant life. And by the time I was 24, I was making more money than my father. And that was hard for a little bit because I felt guilty. You know, how could you, a girl, right? How could I as a woman make more than my dad? And I was in therapy and I worked on it on myself. I always believed in therapy. And I thought, well, I can take care of them if I have to. And so I forged ahead. It was as simple as that.
Wow. So, Sharon, I guess, did that take a period of years or was it a pretty short time? What was that like?
You know, it reminds me of the first time I got a $1 million project. And it was going to be all around the world. There were 9 countries. And I was shivering in my boots. You know, how could I run all these projects where I don't speak the language? And I remember having a therapy session about it and shaking, just absolutely shaking, and coming out of it and going, yeah, I can. And I just did. And that's how it was. So
Because you broke it up into its component parts. That was the solution, right?
Say more about that.
Well, a $1 million sounds like a big deal to someone who's never done a $1 million project, but when you step back and say, well, what's actually involved? And you said, okay, well, I have to contract with these 7 different facilities. And you say, yeah, I've done that before. And I have to write a screener. You know, yeah, I've done that before. And I have to work with a translator. Well, yeah, I've done that before. And, you know, I have to finance the contractors to lay out money before money comes in, but we haven't done it in this scale before, but we had enough money to do it, and you kind of broke it up into its component parts, and then the fear went away. That's what I remember anyway.
Well, and the other part, I think those are all absolutely correct. The other part was, do I deserve to do that? And one of the things was, well, who deserves it more than I? Nobody. Does anybody deserve it? I don't know. Does it matter? No. Go ahead, try it.
That's interesting.
Good for you. Well, Glenn, what about you? What's been some of your biggest influences on money?
I kind of had the opposite experience that Sharon did growing up. My parents had very humble beginnings. They were from poor neighborhoods in the Brooklyn and the Bronx, and, you know, their parents were not first-generation immigrants, but, you know, my grandfather was an orphan, and my grandmother on that side was, you know, from a fairly fairly poor family. And so both of them had grown up without much. And they were the first upwardly mobile people in the family tree. And as a consequence, you know, by the time I was 5 years old, I was living in Great Neck, Long Island. And they wanted me to have everything. They didn't want me to want for anything. And you know, they told me I wasn't really going to have to work. They would support me all the way through graduate school. And, you know, so as a consequence, I don't think that I took money seriously enough. I don't think that I grew up with a sense of being able to earn. I grew up with a sense of being very smart. I grew up with a sense of being hardworking and feeling like, you know, I'm just going to go out and be a doctor, and there really wasn't going to be a problem. But as a consequence, I, in retrospect, I think that It's a mistake for wealthy parents to give their children too much because it makes life more difficult for them later on. And, you know, I when I married Sharon and she was doing these really big projects, the numbers were kind of frightening to me. You know, I thought about being a psychologist and maybe making $100,000 a year. Mm. But then I was writing, my name started to go onto these checks that were, you know, $20,000, $50,000 large, and I just had tremendous anxiety about it. So, I think I kind of have a hole in my financial blueprint like that, where I was sheltered in a way to think that money wasn't as important as it actually is. And it took me years to overcome that.
Well, and it really struck me as you were saying that, Glenn, you know, I thought of physicians, particularly specialists, and most physicians make at least $180,000, $200,000 a year, and many of their kids grow up and don't really have a particular want, per se. So if you're speaking to a physician out there that maybe is raising kids and thinking of how they can overcome this particular challenge, what would you say to them?
Well, I think kids need to work. I think kids need to work for their own money, and they need to have that experience that they know how to take care of themselves, and they have their own bank account, and they, you know how to budget and save for things that they really want to, and they could go out and work harder if they have a really big goal. And I think regardless of how much money you have in the bank as a parent, that kids need to have that experience. I think that's the biggest thing. And okay. I really think that children should be taught I think doctors should be taught entrepreneurial skills also, but I think that, you know, children should be encouraged to go out and start little businesses when they're young and have the experience of failing and seeing that it's not so bad, and learning how to manage cash flow and how to, you know, Sharon and I went through a really bad period financially, and I remember the impact of that on me was that I was so shocked that the bottom was so much further down than I thought it was. I really thought that if you were more than 30 days or 60 days, God forbid, to pay your vendors, I thought there were these two men in white suits and mustaches that came and took all your stuff. And, you know, we went through, I think you might want to talk about this later, but we went through a period after 9/11 where we were as much as 15 months behind because we were in a really bad business situation and we were just running on fumes.
Wow.
And I think if I'd had some of those experiences earlier on, it wouldn't have been as nerve-wracking for me, and I would have taken better care of myself physically, and I would have just thought, you know, these are numbers on a sheet. I have to stay in contact with everybody. I have to manage the numbers, but in the end, it's money and I can do this.
So, Sharon, let me redirect this back to you. So,
sure.
Right now, Glenn's telling us about this moment of time that sounds like it was really, really rough. Take us back to kind of the beginnings of that. How did this happen, this rough time?
So, yeah. So we were going to have a baby and wanted to redirect my travel so that I could work from home, you know, be home. And we opened up a facility, and we invested a lot of money in opening up a circuitry facility on Long Island of 8,000 square feet. We, you know, fully decorated it and put the latest state-of-the-art equipment in it. And we were just getting our legs. It was just getting to be popular when 9/11 happened. And, oh, my God.
And this was in Manhattan or one
it was
of the
out
boroughs?
On Long, it was out on Long Island that had we knew that there was $23 million worth of focus groups that were being conducted on Long Island every year. And we made the most outstanding facility, and we thought we could scoop up most of that. But if, you know, after 9/11, nobody was coming to New York, let alone Long Island, so the business died, just totally died. And as a matter of fact, 9/11 changed this whole industry of you know, focus groups and one-on-one interviews in person. People stopped traveling. And so We kept it open until 2003, trying to, you know, get it back. But we had $150,000 nut to crack every single month because we had a big staff in order to make things work. And we finally just had to bite the bullet and give it up. And I went back to becoming a moderator. And at that time, is it okay, Glenn, if I mention what was going on with you?
Yeah.
Glenn was sick, and we didn't know what was wrong. It took us a number of years to figure it out. But in 2008, we finally figured out he'd had Lyme disease for 10 years.
Wow.
And, you know, he had these, I used to call him, on a scale of 1 to 5, he'd say his headache was a 10. And it was, so it was a really, really difficult time. But you know, the thing that I think we're both incredibly proud of is that we paid off our debt in 5 years. We totally paid it off.
Tell me about that. Why don't you tell me, Glenn, how debt is a big part of this podcast. We have a lot of physicians with $250,000, $300,000 in medical school debt, so plus a lot of practice owners that have debt on their building or whatever. Tell us how you guys did that.
Well, before we built the business, I think we had like $300,000 of savings that we decided to invest in the business. So slowly, we invested all at once. But then once 9/11 came, we just started taking out loans and, you know, paddling as hard as we could to keep things open because we were spending $150,000 a month to keep our employees and our, you know, state-of-the-art facility open. And I think just before 9/11, we were making back 60. We were on a good trajectory, and you could see that, you know, over the course of a year, we were going to cross into profitability and that it was going to make a lot of money. But it went down to almost nothing. And so we were, like, bleeding to the tune of $150,000 a month after that, or maybe $130,000. And so we did what we knew how to do, which was to go back to selling intellectual capital. We would design and analyze studies for these large corporations. And that million-dollar project that we talked about previously was something that we had – we invented a research protocol, which is a very special research protocol, and it was a way to attach emotional purchase motivation to the features and functions of a product without asking people directly. And we were, so we had the capacity to generate a bunch of money, not enough to really keep the facility open through the turmoil, but enough to make it possible to keep losing money. And so we computerized the protocol and started selling it online, not selling an online execution of it. And, you know, we figured out when all was said and done 2 years later, and Sharon went out and just sold her little heart out to sell focus groups and interviews. And so we actually earned a lot of money during that period of time, but it wasn't, we funneled it all into the facility and more. We took out loans on our house. We figured out that we actually lost $2 million on the facility. And if we hadn't opened it, we'd have another $2 million in the bank in hindsight. But that's how we got through. And then I was pretty sick by the end of all that. And for a while, I really couldn't work. And so Sharon, for a year or two, was mostly responsible for paying back a lot of the debt. Then I got better and started, you know, getting my stuff again.
This actually reminds me of a podcast with another physician, Gary Sneed, and Gary was talking about how the regulations have been changing so much within healthcare that their practice regularly is running in the red. And they're having to shift and make some changes to go along with that. And it's ironic because there's not very many primary care physicians in the area that they're servicing. And I know, Sharon, you told me before we started that you've interviewed over 25,000 different physicians. So as you think about the different physicians that you've talked to and some of the projects and some of the experiences you've been through, what do you think some lessons are that you think doctors can apply in building their practices?
So one of the things that Glenn talked about early on in this conversation was deciding not to go the HMO route. And what I've seen happen over the years is that the doctors who are really successful are the ones who have very specific specialties, you know, high-end types of specialties, or ones who've opted out. So I think I mentioned before, like cosmetic surgery or all the anti-aging doctors, you know, the dermatologists who are now doing the Botox and fillers and all of that, they have no trouble because those procedures are not covered and the people who come in and have them are doing it with disposable income. And what they get to do that other doctors who are, you know, under the whip of the HMO, they can spend a half hour, they can spend an hour, they can spend as much time as they want and give really, you know, wonderful service. And then there are those who, the doctors who create these concierge practices, again, they go off the radar of the HMO and they get to create the kind of work that they want. Now, I talk to lots and lots of primary care doctors. They're miserable. They are miserable. They get to spend 5 to 10 minutes with a patient, and there can be all kinds of, you know, doorknob conversations that are really critical that never get answered, and they're not happy with their lot. And so what they really need to do is figure out a way to offer services that people are willing to pay for. And I mean, the other thing that, you know, can we all be, you know, like, forgive me for saying this, but like priests and nuns and do it for basically for free out of our, you know, good nature and still have a good life? And it's much harder, much, much harder, because those are the ones who are having to do the 5 minute you know, patient appointments and not feeling fulfilled, just feeling, you know, beaten.
Yes, yes. Well, I know, Glenn, something that I heard you say in a different podcast was that in creating new things and building a practice, you know, one of the things that was on your heart and having all of this whole family of different people that are white coats was that you didn't just want to be the doctor next door, the country doctor. I can't exactly remember the term that you used, and that you wanted to build something bigger, something different. So there's a physician out there that's listening to this conversation, and they're thinking, you know, I want that to be me. I want to build something bigger. I don't want to be reliant, as Sharon was saying, on just doing regular medicine. Maybe I want to explore something like concierge medicine or have a nationwide practice. Could you speak to that a little bit and what that evolution has been like for you?
Well, for me, it was an interest in psychoeducation. Because there were so many country doctors in my family, I felt like, you know, as a country doctor, you can affect a few thousand people in your local area in the long run. But I really felt that I developed skills as a clinician that were really valuable. Like they were soul changing. They were really life enhancing. And it bothered me to have spent all this time and all this money and all the experience I had working with thousands of people to, maybe not thousands, hundreds at that point, to learn how to do this and not be able to impact the world with it. So I really wanted to know, how do you write a book and disseminate it? How do you build these online programs and membership sites? How do you do offline newsletters? And I really wanted to understand marketing so that I could create value on a broader scale. And seeing all of my colleagues decimated by managed care, I wanted to teach people how to overcome that so that they weren't going to be sitting and filling out insurance forms, but actually working with people and helping them.
Can you think of a specific example of someone like, hey, that sounds pretty good, you know, a physician is listening to this, and, you know, that sounds pretty good, I'd like to do that. What would that look like, do you think, for them? Walk me through the steps that it would take to get there.
Well, I mean, I know a physician that teaches about back pain. And they learned a, I think there's some variation on the Travel technique for back pain or something like that. And they really believe that they've, for certain types of back pain, are able to make a tremendous difference. And that there's information that can make a tremendous difference. They don't necessarily have to be administering a treatment. Mm. And so they, you know, created a set of interviews and videos and, you know, a book and some exercises, and they created a website, and they started buying search advertising for that website. For people that don't know, if someone types in sciatica into, you know, into Google or Bing, it's possible to advertise just to those people and only pay when they click on the keywords. And so they started doing that type of keyword advertising and building a list and, you know, giving out a lot of free information and free videos to indicate when, you know, how you might be able to solve this at home. And then they would just every now and then tease about, you know, how they could purchase this DVD, or if they were really interested, they could come into this membership site and he would answer their questions. And, you know, he was able to build that up to an income that was similar to what you're describing the average physician would make, and gave him a lot of options. He still sees patients, and I think he still actually does deal with the insurance companies to a certain extent, but he doesn't have to, you know, give him a lot of options. So it's that kind of thing.
Well, it sounds like, I use this term sometimes, kind of a side hustle is kind of how something like this starts out. And it could be from, I believe you said, writing a book or doing a course or doing some videos, that kind of piece by piece someone puts that together and just tests it. Is that fair?
Yes. You don't want to quit your day job until it's really going, and you have a sense of how the industry works. And it's an industry that's really oversold. It's made to sound like it's a lot easier than it is, and right. There really is a steep learning curve, but it's possible. It's very possible to do.
May I add something to that?
Please.
I mean, I think that in recent years, patients and doctors have gotten into an adversarial kind of relationship, and what patients need is advocacy. And so what I've seen some doctors do is become patient advocates. And they blog about it, and they make themselves a trusted source so that people can learn from them, and then they can sell materials in that kind of way. They can have a website where they can, you know, buy articles or just use it to develop a relationship so that they want to come in and see them. And then, as Glenn was saying, if you have specialized ideas or services or products, including, I mean, there are some doctors, you know what I've seen a lot of is the whole integrative medicine kind of thing, where you have traditional doctors who are learning, you know, homeopathy and naturopathy, and so now people come to them for a more holistic view of health, and in that role, they can sell them things like vitamins and supplements and different kinds of approaches. So that becomes another source of income.
Well, it really, really strikes me, too, that a big part of this journey of being able to promote yourself, not that you're trying to be something that you're not, but in this world today where people do a Google search for you, what better than to have your own results pop up rather than someone else's?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I was talking, another one of the interviews that we had that I think I'm going to repost not too long after this interview, was an interview with Kevin Foe, who runs Kevin MD. It's kind of like the Huffington Post for physicians. And
cool.
It's something where now, I'm sure for him, I don't know the numbers, but he gets, I looked into advertising and it's thousands and thousands of dollars into advertising. So I said I was going to pass on that one. It was too rich for my blood. So we've seen this done. It does happen. But it takes some time. Now, as we wrap up here, I want to think about one more question. I think what you guys have brought today was this great point of ways to start a side hustle, start a business, to drive in patients and overcome Medicare reimbursement, some of this stuff. And I know one of the biggest issues we see today with physicians is burnout. as we were talking about earlier, Sharon, it's just doctors seem to be asked more and more of them, and they have less and less time. Besides some of the other things that we've talked about so far, do you have any other one or two remedies, Sharon, that you would prescribe to a physician that's struggling with burnout?
Well, for one, and I mentioned we have one of our coaches is a burnt-out doctor who went and took care of himself, and he learned how to meditate and do all kinds of things to get over it, who is now coaching doctors on burnout. So I this is something that's coming into the world where it's being recognized that the people who take care of people really need to be taken care of, you know, caring for the caregiver. And I would have people reach out to that kind of a person so you can learn techniques to take care of yourself. The burden on a doctor is enormous, and the payback is less and less and less, both in terms of pay, both in terms of aggravation from HMOs, and then pushback from patients when they say, why didn't you give me this medicine? I saw it on TV, and it says it's going to do this, this, and that, but you're not recommending it to me. And the doctor's going, man, I don't even have time to learn about the newest, latest thing. Yeah, you know, the rep came in, but I didn't have time to talk to her. And so they're under tremendous stress. And so they need to learn how to take care of themselves first so they have that energy.
Absolutely, and I think it'd be great to connect with the folks you mentioned. We've also, I'm going to link in the show notes interviews with Dyke Drummond and Kim Akins for everyone to take a look at as some ways to overcome that. And Glenn and Sharon, we're running out of time here, and as we wrap up this interview, I'd like you to ponder this question for a second. Well, if you could give a gift to a physician, maybe it's a book, a CD, a DVD, a podcast, or a course, some sort of resource, I want you to think about maybe three different age groups of physicians: medical students that are just learning and growing, residents or newly practicing physicians, and then physicians that have been practicing that are looking towards retirement. So first, we'll start out with med students. What gift would you give to a medical student today?
I would give them hope, hope that there is a future for medicine, hope that their wildest dreams and wishes to contribute to society, it's going to turn around, because as crummy as it is right now with all the HMOs, it can't go on like this. Doctors are too stressed out. So there is hope that this part of the way to serve community will come back.
Great. Any particular resource you think that would be great for them to check out?
Oh.
I would suggest they read a book called How to Live an Inspired Life by Jim Rohn. Have you heard of that?
Jim Rohn. I've heard the name. I've never read the book. Try to Live an Inspired Life. All right. We'll have to check that out.
How to Live an Inspired
Life. How to.
How to. How to Live an Inspired Life. Okay, yeah. And then what about for a resident or young practicing physician? So now they're getting close to being done with all of their training. They're about to start making money, or maybe they're now making finally $180,000, $200,000, $250,000, $300,000. What gift would you like to give to this particular kind of physician?
I would give them a gift of hypnotherapy from me, because I would help them to relax and inspire themselves and have the strength to go on under inadequate situations.
If someone was interested in hypnotherapy, where would be a good resource for them to go to?
To me. you can look up hypnotherapy. The National Guild of Hypnotists is the most recognized organization in the world. That's where I was trained to train trainers. So that would be a good resource. NGH, I think it's NGH.org. National Guild of Hypnotists.
Great. Well, we will put that in the show notes, because obviously with preparing for burnout and some of the long hours to go through, I could definitely see something like that be a benefit. And then, Glenn, what about for a practicing physician? They're 25 years in, you know, they're looking towards retirement. What sort of gift would you give them, a CD, a DVD, a podcast, or a course? What would you give to them?
I'm not allowed to say an ant farm, right?
Yes, you are. This is the one place where you can, Glenn.
I'm sorry. I'm having a little bit of a brain fart. So we're talking about a physician that's approaching retirement and needs something to keep them on the course and feel settled. Dave, I'm so sorry. I'm drawing a blank on it. I'm so sorry.
I have one, Glenn, that you will
okay.
like. and that is to consider taking their skills to another step in becoming a coach, becoming a, you know, a health advocate, becoming a patient advocate, and coaching people. I mean, so many people, you know, we've had great aunts and uncles get really, really sick, and there was no one advocating for them. And so that's something that one might consider doing, or coaching people how to take care of themselves when they're under this kind of stress. And they pay for that. It's something that they can be developing in their, you know, last years of practicing. And, you know, doctors like to work. Doctors have a really wonderful work ethic, and this is the way they can work until they're 100.
Absolutely. Well, then having someone to keep you accountable, someone to – because often what's interesting is a lot of physicians, they're actually, when they're burned out or they might be struggling, they feel like they can't go to other medical professionals because they could get essentially barred for seeking help. So that there's kind of this vicious cycle that goes on. So having some sort of coach, I could totally see working well. Well, there's so much more that we could talk about, micro tests and building practices and all that kind of fun stuff. But we just don't have time to go there, you guys. So do you have any closing thoughts that you think doctors listening to this podcast should be aware of?
I want to tell you that people still really revere you. You're needed. You're like the loving parent that they need and want to take care of their boo-boos. And you're their protectors. And I want you to feel the value of that, no matter how difficult it is.
Wonderful. Glenn?
And I think that it's really easy to get caught up with the complainers. It's because there really is an overwhelming problem in the way that medicine has evolved and the insurance companies have taken over. But the doctors that I see succeeding, they don't spend too much time complaining. You wind up out to dinner with a bunch of doctors, and most of them get involved with the conversation about how awful it is. But the ones that I see really succeeding, they don't really get involved with those conversations too much. They think about what they can do about it, even though it seems impossible. So I think that's an easy first step, is to just watch how much you indulge the group complaints, because that's a victim's mentality. That's a slave's mentality, and it's just a complaint about the master. But the more you complain about the master, the more you become a slave. So try to step aside from there.
Absolutely. I'm sure trying to think of proactive ways to improve it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Glenn and Sharon. If people have more questions, where can they find you? How can they get in contact with you?
Well, they can call me, 603-505-5000. That's my cell, and I do get back to people. It might take me a day or two, but I do get back, and I'd be happy to.
That's a really
good contact point, and if people are interested in our online marketing thoughts and abilities, they might go to freemarketingaudios.com.
That was freemarketingaudios.com?
Yep.
Okay, great. Well, if you are a physician or you're someone serving physicians like Glenn and Sharon, I would love to tell your story. It would be my honor to host you on the next podcast. Make sure to contact me, Dave, at daviddeniston.com or on my website, drfreedompodcast.com. Remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, live a liberated lifestyle. Also, if you gain some value out of this podcast, I would be eternally grateful if you could take 5 minutes, review it on iTunes, review it on Google Play. The reviews help more and more physicians become aware of this podcast. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. Thank you again so much for joining us. Make sure to subscribe. Check in again soon. Have a good one.